Welcome to another episode of Vine Abiders with me, Chris White. Vine Abiders is a live stream Bible study every other Wednesday night at 7 p.m. on YouTube and Facebook. You can also get the pre-recorded podcasts on Apple and Spotify. The Hub is at Substack, where you can subscribe for email alerts. We're also now on shortwave radio in Europe and AM and FM radio in the Tampa area in the U.S. All right, we are moving right along in the Sermon on the Mount, and we've come to Matthew 5, 38 through 42, which says, "You have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, do not resist an evil person. But whoever slaps you on your right cheek, turn the other to him also. If anyone wants to sue you and take your shirt, let him have your coat also. Whoever forces you to go 1 mile, go with him too. Give to him who asks of you, and do not turn away from him who wants to borrow from you." All right, so I would argue that this section in the Sermon on the Mount is teaching us about non-resistance. Don't resist an evil person. And I think that informs the four examples that he gives: physical, with about the cheek slapping; law, with regard to suing; work, with regard to someone forcing you to go 1 mile; and giving, when someone asks of you, don't turn away from him. So all four of those are subjects that are important in other places, but in this section, it's particularly about the subject of non-resistance. And I'll explain the distinction there as we progress, but first, I want to talk about the law that Jesus cites to begin this section. He says, "You have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth." This is following the same pattern in this section where Jesus begins with an Old Testament law or ordinance, and then he expands on it. He intensifies it. The law says not to murder, but I say don't even be angry. The law says don't commit adultery, but I say don't even lust after a woman. So the pattern is typically I'm stating a law, he's agreeing with the law more or less, but then he is intensifying it and making it a matter of the heart rather than just a matter of not doing the actual act. There are a few places in the Old Testament that speak of the law Jesus is referring to, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Probably the most clear cut, though, is in Leviticus 24, 17 through 20, which says, "If a man takes the life of any human being, he shall surely be put to death. The one who takes the life of an animal shall make it good life for life. If a man injures his neighbor, just as he has done, so shall it be done to him, fracture for fracture, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, just as he has injured a man, so it shall be inflicted on him." So a brief explanation of this is that this is a sentencing document. Basically, it's telling the judges how they should carry out sentences. So if someone committed a crime, they would take them before the judges. And if someone murdered somebody and he was convicted of murder, then the sentencing would be death. If someone killed an animal, the sentencing would be repay that animal. So if you killed an ox, you'd have to repay an ox. But then it asks the question, well, what if somebody just gets injured? How do you repay that? And that is the eye for an eye or tooth for a tooth, fracture for fracture. So that is the sentencing from the court if someone gets injured. And it should be said here that this, the capital punishment and things like the eye for an eye and tooth for a tooth, we don't have a lot of examples of that being done in the Old Testament. I think it's pretty widely understood that Israel pretty quickly abandoned these sentencing requirements. We don't have a lot of instances of it being done. You know, certainly by Jesus's day, they weren't doing the capital punishment like the law said. They had found ways around it. They would do, you know, monetary paying back for different things. Of course, by Jesus's day, they literally could not even carry out the law with regard to capital punishment if they wanted to, because they were under Roman rule. And one of the things that Rome didn't let you do is carry out capital punishment on your own terms. That's why they had to go to Pilate to get Jesus killed, because Pilate, as the Roman sort of authority, he was the only one that could carry out capital punishment in that time. But it seems that they were abandoning this long before this as well. But anyway, let's get back to the main point here. I think this is a really interesting situation here, because I think that I read this completely backwards most of my life until I did this study. So the way I used to read it is that Jesus was saying, the law said an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, meaning, and I read that as the law says, take vengeance on somebody, you know, get the just desserts out of somebody. If they do something, you do it to them right back. But I say to you, don't resist an evil person. So Jesus is saying, the law says get revenge, but I say don't get revenge. In other words, this would be, the way I used to read this was Jesus doing the opposite of what the law said. Like the law was completely wrong in its entire direction, and Jesus goes 180 degrees the other way. And the problem with that is that's not the pattern that we've seen before with this exact same situation where he would say, the law says don't commit adultery, which he obviously still agrees with, but I say don't even lust. So in that, and in every instance before this, he is agreeing, but intensifying. He's making that law stronger in a sense, but and making it more of a part of the heart as opposed to just some action, as I said. And what I think that I've learned through the course of this study is that Jesus is following that same pattern here with the eye for an eye and don't resist an evil person situation. But I didn't understand that before because I didn't understand the law about eye for an eye or tooth for a tooth. I saw that law as about vengeance when it's probably the exact opposite. That is the limiting of vengeance. It is making sure that your punishment corresponds to the injury and doesn't exceed it. In other words, a judicial way to make sure that you don't take vengeance. And if you understand that, then it follows the pattern exactly. So Jesus would be saying, you've heard it said that you should not give someone vengeance over and above what they deserve, but I'm saying to you, don't even take vengeance at all. If that's the way you read it, then this is exactly like all the others. And this interpretation of the eye for an eye law, that is to limit vengeance, is pretty common among scholars. Jacob Milgram, in his Leviticus commentary in 2001, calls eye for an eye a, quote, formula of justitialis, limiting punishment to the measure of injury. Raymond Westbrook and Bruce Wells, in their Everyday Law in Biblical Israel in 2009, describe it as a doctrine of proportionality designed to curb unlimited vengeance common in early kinship-based systems. One possible example of a kinship situation getting out of control is in Genesis 34, where the Israelites had one of their relatives raped. And as a result, there's a long, convoluted situation, but they basically killed everyone in the whole tribe. Jacob, I believe it was at the end of his, like, you've made my name odious among these people. It's unclear to me whether that's supposed to be a good thing or a bad thing, but certainly Jacob's interpretation of it was like, great job, guys. You killed the whole clan. My point here is kind of like gang warfare rules. If you kill somebody, well, they're going to escalate that and kill two other, three other people. And now they've killed three people. So, wow, we've got to go kill four or five people, you know? So this consistent escalation pattern. So what this prescription does, this eye for an eye does, is it limits vengeance. It limits the ability to take more than was owed. And so I do believe now that what Jesus was saying when he said, you've heard it said, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, his readers would have heard, you've heard it said, don't take vengeance more than it was owed, but I say to you, don't even resist an evil person. So he's doing what he was doing in other places. He's agreeing with the initial idea to not take vengeance more than it's owed, but he's going a step further and saying, I say to you, don't even resist an evil person. So that there's a reason to believe it. I think another reason not to read it the way that I was before, which is that an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth in the Old Testament was about getting vengeance from a person. Like that was the purpose of saying that, was because vengeance is definitely not something that the Old Testament agrees with. In other words, it's not just a New Testament thing to not get vengeance. Leviticus 19:18 says, you shall not take vengeance, nor bear any grudge against the sons of your people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord. And it's not just about the sons of your people either. It's about everybody. Deuteronomy 32, 35 says, "Vengeance is mine and retribution. In due time, their foot will slip, for the day of their calamity is near, and the impending things are hastening upon them." So he's saying, I'll take care of vengeance. Don't worry, I've got them. The people that deserve what they're going to get, I'm going to take care of it. We see that again in Proverbs 22, which says, "Do not say, I will repay evil. Wait for the Lord, and he will save you." Proverbs 24, 29 says, "Do not say, thus I shall do to him as he has done to me. I will render to the man according to his work." And that brings me to another aspect of this that's important to understand, which is that when a law or a punishment is carried out in a judicial context, there is no vengeance happening there, especially when the law in question is something that God gave to people to do. So let me explain what I mean by that. So you would be tempted to say, well, I'm saying that vengeance is not something that either the Old Testament or New Testament condones. You're never supposed to say, I'm going to do to that person as they have done to me. That's not okay in the Old Testament or the New Testament. And yet, we also have this law that says, take an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. If somebody kills somebody, you got to kill them back. And if they, you know, so how do we reconcile that? Well, it's in a judicial context. If, for example, in our modern day, if a judge sentences somebody to death, he's not taking vengeance on that person. He is doing what the law says. There's a law in the books that says if a person is convicted by a jury of their peers, then in that case, and the jury recommends the death penalty and they get the death penalty, then you've got to sentence that person to death. He is not taking vengeance on that person through that situation. And that's especially true when the law in question is not some state law that was, you know, signed by legislators or whatever, but it's a law that God gave them. That God said, when you have a person that does this, I'm saying that you should do this to them. So it's out of their hands. The law was written by God. They're just carrying out the sentencing that God said to do. So it's completely non-vengeance in their situation. Now, it would be vengeance if they didn't go through that channel. If they had a vigilante, for example, that didn't get a jury of their peers or two witnesses to say that this person did that or whatever, take them to the court or the judges, but instead they just killed them because they killed somebody else. That would be vigilantism, and that would be vengeance, and that would be against the law. All right, so we have extensively covered the eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth concept. Let's move on to what Jesus now says. He says, "But I say to you, do not resist an evil person. But whoever slaps you on your right cheek, turn the other to him also. If anyone wants to sue you and take your shirt, let him have your coat also. Whoever forces you to go 1 mile, go with him too. Give it to him who asks you, and don't turn away from him who wants to borrow from you." So these are very hard teachings. Jesus is teaching us that we need to live a life of non-retaliation. This is, in my opinion, one of the most forgotten and disregarded teachings of Christianity today, although there are many. If you've been following this teaching, we've been going through the Sermon on the Mount, and there's basically none of this that Christians do today, but this is definitely one of them. We do not live this life of non-retaliation. I'll go through some quotes later, but the first centuries of the church, as they did believe that Jesus meant every word that he said here and elsewhere in the Gospels, this was considered a defining characteristic of being a Christian, this non-retaliation lifestyle. For those of you that might be tempted to say, oh, this is just Jesus's hard teaching in the Sermon on the Mount, and I believe in Luther, I believe that all this was never meant for Christians to follow in the first place. He was just showing us what not to do, or that we could never do what he said to do. Well, I would say, let's look at Romans 12, 17 through 21. Do you believe that we need to do what's in Romans? I would say that person would probably be like, okay, yeah, I do believe we got to do what's in Romans. Because in Romans 12, 17 through 21, Paul makes it crystal clear that he believes that our passage in Matthew, what Jesus said on the Sermon on the Mount, is what Christians should do, and that there is no other alternative. He says, "Never pay back evil for evil to anyone." That's a pretty hard way to start. Never pay back evil for evil to anyone. "Respect what is right in the sight of all men. If possible, so far as it depends on you, be at peace with all men. Never take your own revenge, beloved, but leave room for the wrath of God. For it is written, 'Vengeance is mine, I will repay,' says the Lord. But if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he's thirsty, give him a drink. For in so doing, you will heap burning coals on his head. do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. In 1 Thessalonians 5, Paul says, "We urge you, brethren, admonish the unruly, encourage the faint-hearted, help the weak, be patient with everyone. See that no one pays another with evil for evil, but always seek after that which is good for one another and for all people." Peter gets in on the action in 1 Peter 3, 8-9, where he says, "To sum up, all of you be harmonious, sympathetic, brotherly, kind-hearted, humble in spirit, not returning evil for evil or insult for insult, but giving a blessing instead. For you were called for this very purpose, that you might inherit a blessing." So those passages show us without a doubt that the apostles believed that what Jesus said on the Sermon on the Mount was expected to be followed, that Jesus was supposed to be telling us how to live as Christians, and that if you want to be a Christian, you've got to live the way that Jesus said to, in this rather difficult way of non-resistance, this way that is indeed a sacrifice, to go against what you most want to do, which is to repay vengeance. You know, vengeance is something that I believe is a dopamine thing too. Have you ever watched like a John Wick movie or any kind of revenge movie? I mean, it's a genre of movie, a revenge movie. You kill my dog, I'm going to go kill the entire planet. And we love it. And I believe that there is a certain amount. I've started to notice this too in movies, that they know that the bad guy getting what he deserves at the end is like this dopamine moment. And so they drag it out. They give him the worst punishment. It's proportional to how bad the bad guy was in the movie. If he was like, man, the whole movie, you're like, man, that guy's just the worst. And then at the end, when he gets just super tortured to death and you're like, yeah, that is why this is a sacrifice to live this other way, because that is our default. And Jesus and the apostles are saying that that's not the way that Christians are to live. And we need to trust that there is a benefit to this. We're going to get to that in the end. There's blessings associated with this. We've already got the sense that God is going to do something. He's going to get the person's back who lives like this. I've got a few quotes here from the early church fathers that shows that they basically understood the assignment with regard to this idea. This is a paraphrase from Ignatius. "When you are wronged, be patient. When you are slandered, bless. When you are persecuted, endure. When you are hated, return love. When you are cursed, pray." I could go on, but you get the idea. This is something that if you were to just be a child and read the New Testament, you would be like, oh, we're supposed to live like this. It's hard to see. And when I read that, you all are recalling things in the New Testament that say that. You know that that's the teaching of the New Testament. But there's just some kind of disconnect between, like, we actually have to do that. Let's catch ourselves the next time that our default is to find vengeance and find a way to bless and to pray and to do whatever we have to break that cycle, in our minds at least. Interestingly, this section on the Sermon on the Mount about turning the other cheek and if someone sues you, give them your cloak also, is probably one of the more influential passages for modern Christianity in a roundabout way. And that way is to do with Martin Luther. So Martin Luther, I believe it was this section in particular that he really didn't like. That the idea of turning your other cheek when somebody struck you was just absolutely not cool to Martin Luther. And I believe that if you've ever read Martin Luther's writings, you'll understand why that would be. He was a person that was filled with the idea of vengeance. You almost can't, you know, if you pick a paragraph at random of Martin Luther's writings, you're going to find in there him talking about somebody. He's going after somebody. He's calling them names. He is mad at somebody. He is filled with vengeance and rage. And so this idea to Luther was just not cool at all. Let me read some quotes about this section from Luther. It says, "If someone were to strike a Christian prince on one cheek, he should not turn the other, but instead protect his people and punish the offender." In other words, Luther thinks that you should do the exact opposite of what Jesus did. He goes on and says that it would be foolish to do what Jesus said. It says, "Therefore, it would not be right to teach here to turn the other cheek, and to throw away the cloak after the coat, for that would be just plain the fool." Luther feels confident in saying that Jesus is talking foolishness here, because in Luther did the one thing that I've said before in the Defamation Part 3, for example, I think the most influential thing that's ever happened to Christianity, something that Martin Luther invented, had never been done before, came up with the idea that Jesus didn't really mean anything that he was saying in the Sermon on the Mount. He was basically just showing us that his standards were so high that we could never possibly meet them. And so it was just going to drive us to grace through faith. And so the whole Sermon on the Mount to Luther was a kind of word game. He says this: the law in the Sermon on the Mount is given so that man, feeling his own inability to keep it, may learn to despair of himself and seek help in Christ. So Luther invented the idea that you didn't need to follow Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount because it wasn't even meant to do that. Jesus wasn't teaching how to be a Christian in the Sermon on the Mount. He was teaching us that you can't do anything that he says. Moving on to the next example of non-resistance in this passage, which has to do with lawsuits. It says, if anyone wants to sue you and take your shirt, let him have your coat also. So this is another super hard teaching. Again, you can see why Martin Luther and people like him, including me, you know, would resist this. You're telling me that if somebody wants to sue me, and it's with regard to whether they're right or not, maybe they're just trying to defraud me, and you're telling me that I should just give them what they want? That seems, you know, very extreme. But this is exactly what Paul teaches. Again, Paul picks up Jesus's teachings, which seems to tell people not to sue each other. And I believe Paul makes it clear that this is with regard to Christians. Like, Christians don't sue other Christians. If another Christian wants to sue you, just let them have whatever they want, even if it's unreasonable. That seems to be the teaching of Paul. And I believe that his teaching is that because he's just taking the logical conclusion of Jesus's teachings. But we read in 1 Corinthians 6, 1 through 7, and I've got this quoted here, but I think the last part is really the heart of this, what he says: actually then, it's already a defeat for you that you have lawsuits with one another. Why not rather be wronged? Why not rather be defrauded? Paul seems to be saying, let yourself be defrauded, which is the logical conclusion of Jesus's teachings about lawsuits. I think part of this is about trust and obedience. Trust because of what the point of the Old Testament passages were when they talk about not taking vengeance for yourself. And their reasoning is because God will take vengeance for you. Vengeance is mine. God is jealous for vengeance. If you are going to obey him and not take vengeance, even though somebody should, something needs to be set right here. This isn't right. I've been defrauded. Well, God says, let me handle that. But I really, really, really don't want you to handle that. And so this is just a continuation of that teaching. So there's faith involved. Do you believe that God will help you out, whatever that means? We're going to look later that there are reasons behind this hard teaching, blessings and promises. So number one, are you going to have faith that God will fight for you on your behalf if you obey him? And the second part is, are you going to obey? Because we have basically taken obedience as optional in this modern world. Are we going to look at things like this as things that we need to do, that we are under obligation to do if we're going to continue to call ourselves followers of the way, followers of Jesus? Because if we take our own vengeance, then how can we say that we are followers of Jesus if we don't follow Jesus? The next part of this passage about non-resistance is with regard to, I guess, work would be the subtitle here. Whoever forces you to go 1 mile, go with him 2. So you've probably heard that there was a Roman law that you could say, hey, you Jewish guy over here, you carry my pack 1 mile. They had a law that forced them to do that. And Jesus is saying, if a Roman soldier makes you do that, don't just go with him that first mile that you're obligated to, go with him the second mile. But when doing research for this, it was brought up that that might also explain the incident where Simon the Cyrene was compelled to carry Jesus's cross in Mark 15:21. So when Jesus collapsed on the way to Golgotha, the Roman soldiers exercised this right, the Angaria law, to press Simon into service. Hey, you over here, come carry this burden up to 1 mile. And so Simon carried the cross of Jesus up to Golgotha. It would be interesting, actually, if you knew what the distance between how many miles Simon carried it. It would be interesting if he carried it 2 miles. This last area of non-resistance in this passage is about giving. Give to him who asks of you, and do not turn away from him who wants to borrow from you. I think this is interesting because it's not just about giving necessarily. It's about non-resistance with regard to giving. So, for example, there's lots of places in the New Testament where we could quote passages about giving, God loves a cheerful giver, and widows might, and on and on and on. There's really a lot of passages about money and the right usage of money. But I think that the difference here, as this is in the context of non-resistance, it's when people ask you for money, or when somebody asks you for a loan, it's saying you give it to them. And so it's non-resistance with regard to money. So it's a different or sub-teaching with regard to money. I've got a few passages that I think are close to this idea that I've quoted here. 1 John 3:17, but whoever has the world's goods and sees his brother in need and closes his heart against him, how does the love of God abide in him? Galatians 6:9-10, let us not lose heart in doing good, for in due time we will reap if we do not grow weary. So then, while you have opportunity, let us do good to all people, and especially to those who are of the household of faith. And in Hebrews 13:16, and do not neglect doing good for sharing, for with such sacrifices, God is well pleased. And I think you could say, you know, like James was saying, if you see somebody in the church and don't say be warmed and filled, and the person who just says that but actually does something for them, or perhaps even Good Samaritan and what he did there. I think it's different because in none of those cases is the person asking for a handout. It's more like you're seeing a need and you have the ability, then you need to do it. So it's kind of like they're asking, you're seeing a poor and hungry person in front of you, is in a sense, I think that I'm trying to make the connection that maybe that connects to the non-resistance in terms of giving, but perhaps I'm stretching that a little bit too far. To conclude, I'll read some passages that I picked out that I think in some way or another speak to the why should we live like this. You know, this is asking us to live a rather counterintuitive, radical way to not defend ourselves, to let God defend us, to give when people ask, to let ourselves be defrauded in some cases. Why should we do this? And here are a few passages that I think at least have some aspect where they say, because you get this. So Luke 6:35-36, love your enemies, do good, lend, expecting nothing in return, and your reward will be great. And you will be sons of the Most High. So it doesn't say what the reward is there, but it will be great. So interpret that how you will, but know that there is a promise of reward for this radical behavior. And you'll be sons of the Most High. So interpret that how you will. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And certainly there are lots of passages about persecution and rewards being great. You know, jump for joy, for your reward is great in heaven, which speaks to me of like, wow, jumping for joy when persecuted because of righteousness' sake, because man, there is a big reward waiting for you. Romans 5:3-4, we rejoice in our sufferings, knowing that suffering produces endurance, and endurance character, and character hope. So hope is the end goal here, but you also get a change of your character, and that's what you get through this life of self-sacrifice. You get to be a better person in this life too. Matthew 5:5, blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. So a blessing, obviously, for being meek, which is sort of the quality behind a lot of this non-resistance, for they shall inherit the earth. So there is definitely a eternal life component, which is the inheritance of the earth. And then Philippians 3:10, that I may know him and share in his sufferings. I didn't really get into it. I actually cut the section for time about this idea of sharing in his sufferings, and we're doing that because he suffered, we also suffer, and that's a part of the union with Christ idea. It's a really interesting concept that is very mysterious and important for Christians, or at least it seems to be. I'm not sure I fully understand it, but I equate suffering in the way that we're talking about in this section with that. It is suffering to live the life that Christ tells us to live in this section, a self-sacrificing life, a life of non-resistance. Like all the things that we do when we resist our natural proclivities, it is, in a sense, suffering. 2 Corinthians 4:10 through 11, we always carry in the body the death of Jesus so that the life of Jesus may also be manifested in our bodies. So why are you suffering in that way, caring about the body of death of Jesus, which I would argue is a part of the suffering of following his commandments, so that the life of Jesus may also be manifested in our bodies? So that sounds like a pretty good situation too. Then we have 1 Peter 4:14, which says, "If you are insulted for the name of Christ, you are blessed, because the Spirit of glory and of God rests upon you." So again, a pretty good situation if you are insulted for the name of Christ. I think that God goes to battle. His eye is on the person who is non-resistant to evil, who does not repay evil for evil. And he, like it says in the Old Testament and the other passages, that vengeance is his. He is happy to go to battle on your behalf. I think you could prove that over and over. That's what you can have faith in, a promise that God is going to take care of it. I believe that it probably also means that it's going to be taken care of financially, or the things that you're worried about. Have faith in him. Is he God or is he not? Has he told you to do this or has he not? And just trust in him that he's got it covered. You don't need to go to battle on your behalf. You can allow him to take care of it, even if you don't know how he's going to do it. You can trust that it's going to change your character at the very least. But I think the bottom line is that it's just straight trust. If Jesus said to do it, it's probably a good situation, even if it's just for the evangelism aspect. I bet you if you started following Jesus in this way, you would see people's lives around you change because they're seeing something in you that is not normal. I think that's why the early church had such a major impact, is because they were living their lives in accordance with Jesus's words here. And it was so different than anything that the world had seen that it just changed the world. Anyway, that's it for me today. You can go to vineabiders.com, go to Vine Abiders Substack, check it out on YouTube, Facebook, and of course, anywhere you get your podcasts. And we'll see you next time.